RCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. For tens of millions of people, no relief from the record heat. ABC's Morgan Norwood has more.
More than 110 million Americans facing a weekend of dangerous and excessive heat. From Indiana to Pittsburgh, feels like temperatures could reach up to 105 degrees. The blistering heat across the eastern seaboard creating potentially life-threatening conditions for those outdoors for prolonged periods.
Authorities emphasizing hydration and water safety. Three people from Alabama drowned Friday while swimming off Panama City Beach on the Florida Panhandle, while police in New York City searching for two teenagers missing after they were seen being overtaken by a large wave swimming Friday evening. Former President Trump has campaign events today in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. President Biden spending the weekend at Camp David, and authorities in Arkansas still investigating the motive of the mass shooting in Fordyce that left three people dead. This is ABC News. The federal government okayed more flavored e-cigarettes.
The FDA has authorized the marketing of four versions of the Enjoy brand menthol flavored e-cigarettes. And announcing the authorization, the FDA has said the benefits to adult smokers from completely switching to a less harmful product was sufficient to outweigh the risks to youth. The FDA says e-cigs are not considered safe, but they are believed to be safer than traditional tobacco products. So far, the FDA has authorized 27 tobacco and menthol flavored e-cigarette products and devices. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Paris Olympics organizers have decided to cool rooms in the athletes' village with a system of cooling pipes, trying to avoid the environmental impact of air conditioning. But the U.S. is one of a handful of Olympic teams that is going to supply their own AC units for their athletes, saying the athletes felt air conditioning was a critical component to their performance because of the consistency it would provide. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Today's job market is full of demand for skilled trade workers. Electricians, welders, mechanics, these and other trades are the backbone of every community. They're also a huge part in making sure the Army National Guard is always fulfilling its mission of service to our country and communities. Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and supplies moving. The skilled trades these soldiers perform are the same ones needed in today's civilian workforce. Army National Guard soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. With options from plumber to helicopter mechanic and everything in between, soldiers are able to select the trades that best fit their lives. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession and serve your community and country by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Media News, I'm Terry Bell. It's summer vacation season. One Wisconsin travel agent says there are plenty of options, even on a tight budget. Mike Moan reports.
Economists are more optimistic these days when it comes to inflation trending downward, but childcare expenses and higher housing payments remain a burden on household finances. Wisconsin-based travel agent Elsie Rushline says if you're wrestling with the idea of heading out of town, there are ways to stretch your travel budget. One example is booking lodging that comes with a complimentary breakfast.
Sometimes the bigger chains include the breakfast and the littler ones, like the motels and stuff, don't. So you might spend a couple dollars more in the hotel, but you're saving that money, especially if you've got kids. Like, they always want to eat breakfast.
Rushline says you can also grab some snacks from that breakfast to take on your daily adventures. And if you're planning a relatively short road trip, such as a few days in a nearby lake town, she recommends packing food before you drive off to avoid spending money on drinks and other items at gas stations along the way. For households with a little more wiggle room for a trip further away from home, Rushline says it's not too late to book flights or hotels for later in the summer, but she recommends acting now to keep costs lower.
I would say book ahead if you can, because when you're doing last-minute travel, it tends to be a little bit more expensive.
For those sticking with the road but are worried their vehicle won't make the trip, analysts say car rental prices have come down a bit since their post-pandemic spike in 2021. Rushline says, if possible, plan a trip with another family to split those rental costs along with other expenses. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Showers and thunderstorms likely today. Heavy rainfall and some flooding possible. A high near 83. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms with a low of 62. We clear things out for Sunday. Mostly sunny, a high near 80. Warmer on Monday with a high around 86.
It's 73 at our studios.
Earl Ingram.
Monday morning, join me as I stroll through memory lane and take in the sounds of the Motor City. It's Motown Mondays.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10. News from the Center, WRCE. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel. This is our second hour of Amicus, a law review. Delighted, honored to have you with me and my terrific producer, Max, here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We're coming to you from Waukesha, but broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin and well beyond, inviting, as always, your inquiries, your questions. Appreciate our listeners calling in with your questions and comments at 844-967-2789. Or also you can drop a text to Max and me in the Civic Media app and be a part of our discussion. Talking this morning, as we often do this time of year, about the United States Supreme Court, this major decision of just this past week involving guns and Rahimi that also signaled something of a retreat. Something of a good retreat from this fascination that at least some members of the Supreme Court have had with the past in justifying the present and legislation passed in our modern world. Now talking about another case involving taxes. Yes, that's right. Taxes, international matters. And in particular, this case called Moore versus United States of America, right as we were going from hour one to hour two, talking about the Moores, Charles and Kathleen. The predicates for the case are important to understand because it underscores what the case does say and what it doesn't say. And then there's a second reason, as always, for identifying this particular case as important because it has to do with, once again, with ethics on the Supreme Court. We'll get to that in just a moment or so. The Moores, as I indicated, backed by something called the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It's a research organization in Washington. They had investment in India. It fell under this provision of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, changed to accomplish the tax changes of that year that altered how the federal government taxes corporate profits that are earned overseas. And that's the key, overbroad tax earnings. Under this particular provision, United States shareholders, including the Moores, who own 10% or more of some foreign corporations primarily owned or controlled by Americans, have to pay a one-time tax. And that's the point. That's the key. That's the focus of this Jobs Act of 2017. Previously, under the law, they owed taxes only on profits that were brought into the United States of America. So there's a difference here. And an issue, of course, is whether the Moores should be subject to this particular tax changed in 2017, even though they themselves never received or realized any income from their particular investment in question overseas as a part of their supplying these rural farmers in India. In 2016, according to the court records here, the couple invested about $40,000 in a company that supplied these farmers with some basic tools. That's a good thing. And the Moores also received some shares in the company, which started by a friend of the Moores called in this enterprise. And the friend who started this company is named Ravindra Kumar Agrawal, also a part of the lawsuit here and a part of the understanding of the facts of that lawsuit. 2018, the Moores discovered that under the law, they owed income tax on the company's reinvested earnings following all this, dating way back to 2006. And that added about $15,000 to their tax bill. and backed by some groups out there that are concerned about the expansive nature of this tax law. The Moors sued, saying that the particular tax that they're objecting to violated the Constitution's apportionment requirements. Why? Because it taxed their shares in the company, which they characterized as property rather than income that it actually gained. The difference between actually owning something, property, and income that they'd actually gain. A panel of judges on the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit sided with the federal government. And there was a dissenter there who said that history and precedent, kind of like Justice Thomas would say, all of that recognizes that an income on tax must be on unrealized income. That's what the dissent in the lower court was saying. But the Moors appealed to the Supreme Court. We agreed to review this case, and as I indicated, the Supreme Court went in the opposite direction. The Supreme Court finding that indeed this particular tax is constitutional and that there's nothing wrong with the way that it was put into place and that it goes forward. The Moors basically lose. An important case, again, for the tax structure because it keeps things in place. An awful lot of economists out there, people who look at these things closely, tax lawyers, tax managers generally say that if the Supreme Court had gone in the opposite direction, find that this particular version of the law changed in 2017, gone in the opposite direction would have created calamity, catastrophe, arguably, inside our tax system. Did not happen, but probably not the reason for the Supreme Court's deciding this direction. They do, in fact, justify this based upon some history, but also a contemporary implication and application of the law. Now, interestingly, and this is the other reason why the case is important to understand, an awful lot of tax experts said that, you know, you shouldn't even take this case in the first place. When the grant of writ of certiorari was officially announced here, an awful lot of people said you shouldn't even take this case because it's based on some inaccuracies in the factual record. The Moors pushed back on this, said, no, this is all accurate. But in a series of very detailed articles, it also came out at the time this case is being bandied about, a publication called Tax Notes reported that the tax experts said the couple may have been more deeply involved in the company than they suggested in these court filings. And so some reason to believe that in the factual record upon which the Supreme Court decided this case was not complete and that maybe the Moors were not as forthright as they otherwise should have been. Their lawyers plainly saying, nope, that's not true. The record is accurate and complete. More significantly, the other reason why I bring this to the attention of all of our listeners is this. It has an ethics implication as well, and you may remember some of the names associated with this as well. A lawyer for the Moors, his name is David B. Rivkin Jr., R-I-V-K-I-N, had twice interviewed Justice Sam Alito for the Wall Street Journal. Remember this story? On the editorial page in the months before the case was presented, it raised questions at this time. That is, the lawyer for the Moors interviewing Sam Alito, who is deciding this case, raised questions about whether or not that justice should hear the dispute at all. At the time, Alito declined to recuse himself from the case. He wrote in a specific statement that Mr. Rivkin, the lawyer for the Moors in this case, had interviewed him just, quote, as a journalist and not as an advocate. As a journalist, not as an advocate. Therefore, Justice Alito said, I can remain on the case. No recusal necessary at all. The justice said this in particular. He said the case in which he is involved was never mentioned during the interview, nor did we discuss any issue in that case, either directly or indirectly. His, meaning Rivkin's, involvement in the case was disclosed in the second article, and therefore readers could take that into account. And plainly, looking at all of this, an awful lot of people said, well, gee, given the fact that you've been interviewed by the very lawyers who are petitioning in front of you on behalf of their clients in these articles for the Wall Street Journal, these editorial page articles, appropriate right for you to recuse yourself. Justice Alito plainly did not do that in this case, raising again the need for an ethics code, a credible, viable, reasonable, rational ethics code that can be applied uniformly to prevent these kinds of things from happening. Some ethics experts also suggested that Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Thomas and even Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson should also have recused themselves in this case. They have pointed to the stake that each one of those justices holds in a limited liability company or a partnership that could indeed benefit them should the justices declare the tax unconstitutional. They didn't do that here. All three of those justices, in addition to Justice Alito, all of them participated in this, again, raising questions across the board about whether or not justices who could arguably have a benefit, depending upon how the case comes out, should be reviewing the case. The answer plainly is no. We've got at least one justice, again, has a direct connection to the lawyer advocating in front of the Supreme Court. His name again, David Rivkin, interviewing Justice Alito about matters not related to this case, but nonetheless about judicial issues generally, having that connection at a time when the court is also entertaining this very case involving the Moors. A case significant, again, for underscoring the significance of ethics on our Supreme Court. And this notion that we need to rely upon the complete lack of bias, lack of prejudice, lack of particular inclination by members of our Supreme Court on all sides of the political aisle, the reason for the disclosures that they're required to make, more significantly, the reason why our Congress, particularly the United States Senate, continues to ask that the United States Supreme Court not only adopt a code that provides clarity on all these issues. It requires recusals in situations where justices and judges should no longer be addressing these kinds of cases, and also assures us more generally that the decisions that are rendered, whether it's in Moore and Rahimi, all these cases, all these kinds of things, are the subject of a true and genuine application of the law to the facts and the facts to the law, and are not in any way prompted by affiliations with the lawyers for the parties, the parties themselves, and even disclosures about where income comes from, all of those things need to be a part of the public domain so the decisions can be made in a way that are reasonable and rational, and recusals, once again, which judges and justices do all the time to ensure that the fairness and the impartiality of their decisions is not questioned. Often judges will say, you know what? In the interest of ensuring that there is no appearance of impropriety, even if there is no direct conflict, I am going to recuse myself. I'm going to take myself out of this. Why? So that nobody can come back and say that my decision, my involvement in the case was the product of something other than my role as a justice or judge on the case. Again, implicated in this Moore situation that also raises issues for the tax code and presages down the road the possibility this wealth tax, as it is being bandied about in Congress and in politics, might one day return to the Supreme Court. The justices, at least on one side of this case, saying clearly that while we're supporting the tax law in this case, when it comes to a wealth tax, that's a different animal. That may be something very different. We may well be deciding something other than that. And plainly, people like Amy Coney Barrett and Justice Alito telling us just that. As a result of this Moore case pending before the Supreme Court, now resolved, 15 more cases yet to be decided in the days and maybe arguably weeks just ahead. We've got another caller. Always appreciate callers and insights, questions, comments. Jack calling in from Merrimack. Jack, glad to have you a part of our discussion this weekend on Amicus.
Yeah, I have a question which is not directly related to the Supreme Court. And thanks for taking my call, by the way.
Absolutely.
You talked about a lot of things you said that were flying under the radar. I'd like to ask about something that has also been flying under the radar. As far as I know, never mentioned by the media. And even if Trump doesn't get appointed by the Electoral College again, he did not really win the Democratic vote. But anyway, this thing is a continuing danger for our democracy, and that's the Article 5 Convention. From what I've been able to...
And Jack, what I'm going to do just because of time, I'm going to have you hang on to your comment. If you could stick with me, and we'll take up your question right after this as we continue our discussion this morning. Stay with me, Jack, and we'll talk more.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Look up cheese curds. You'll find this basic definition. Wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, talking right now with a caller named Jack. Jack from Merrimack, calling in apparently with a question about something. Likewise, Jack, from your perspective, has flown under the radar. Tell me more about your question, Jack, and we'll see if we can field that right now.
Okay. What I'm calling about is the so-called Article 5 Constitutional Convention, something like that. From what I've been able to research, if I think it's two-thirds of the states call for it, it would essentially allow a no-holds-barred entire revision of our whole Constitution. And at this point, if my research is correct, only six states more need to enact legislation calling for it. Wisconsin, I believe under Walker, passed such legislation, if my memory is correct. Now, while these states represent a minority in population, the last time I checked, the majority of the states were in so-called Republican control. That's really, in this Republican Party, that's the MAGA control. We've already seen the shenanigans. Wisconsin's gerrymandered legislature has pulled with just our Constitution, using the amendment process to bypass the governor and using vague and confusing.
And so, Jack, I assume from all this that you're in favor of a new constitutional convention. Is that what your advocacy is for?
No. In fact, I am concerned.
Okay.
This may actually happen.
All right.
And given the shenanigans that our legislature has already shown here, I consider the Article 5 convention almost as dangerous, perhaps more so even.
An awful lot of people, Jack, I think agree with you. That is that if, in fact, and I think you've got the process here just right, it's not easy to do. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson once said very appropriately that every generation should reconsider the Constitution. He was obviously at the start of our nation. Maybe that would be too volatile, if you will. But he was plainly an advocate for continuing. I think his theory was that we should always be updating things to make certain that they're a reflection of our contemporary world. I think, Jack, your comments about what could happen in a free-ranging constitutional convention are well taken, and that's the concern. If you go forward and you can rewrite the thing from start to finish, question also among an awful lot of people out there whether even a group coming together today could resolve a new constitution in a way that our forebears did, our founding fathers did, an awful lot of compromise taking place way back in 1787 and so forth. Whether that would be possible today in our present climate, an awful lot of questions asked about that. But Jack, again, your particular invocation here of that process does raise the possibility of doing that at some point down the road. My own thought is much like yours, that at least right now, we've got an awful lot of things to settle under our present Constitution, some of which pending before the Supreme Court, a lot of which should be also the subject of statutory responses. Not everything needs to be constitutional in nature, right? A lot of things should be resolved by our statutory authorities, our legislative authorities, and that too would weigh in on whether or not we really need to go back and start over with a brand new constitution. Jack, appreciate your comment and your invocation of the Constitution this morning. We had another caller in our first hour. His advocacy, Thomas, your advocacy was about another judge. Her name is Eileen Cannon. She is the judge who is presiding over the Mar-a-Lago documents case, a place called Fort Pierce, Texas. That is in the Southern District of Florida. That's a federal district in the Southern District there in the state of Florida. And she's presiding over this federal criminal prosecution of Donald Trump. It involves him and two others. They're also alleged to be involved in some obstruction counts. But it has basically to do with whether or not he improperly maintained, took, bandied about, had in his possession, in violation of the federal law, not only documents that were classified, but other documents that he should not have had. We know that the documents laws here vest the property ownership of these documents in whom? In the United States, people, in the constituency generally, all of us own them. They're not owned by a particular president, and that's the premise upon which this prosecution proceeds. She is now presiding over that case. And Thomas, your suggestion was, what do we do in response to a judge there who is plainly slow walking the progress of this case? Indicted a very long time ago, again, by Jack Smith. He is the special counsel. Important point in understanding for what's going on right now. And she is entertaining, again, in this pretrial setting, an awful lot of motions that have been put forth by the defense. Now, defense counsel have an absolute obligation, if you will, an absolute right on behalf of their client to raise defense issues that go to the legitimacy of the indictment, in this case, in any criminal case. You file motions to suppress evidence, things that have come in during the course of the investigation. You file motions to dismiss. We've seen that in the case involving the Georgia election interference case, where the judge entertained the possibility that some portions of that charge, that state charge, in Georgia were improperly drafted. Indeed, the judge there dismissed six counts. That came on a motion to dismiss a part of that set of charges, that grand jury indictment there in Georgia. Here again, the defense counsel has an obligation, if you will, on behalf of their client to raise all kinds of motions. That is not to say that every single motion has the merit of every other motion on the list of motions that are presented. And it is not unusual, not at all unusual, for judges, when they're presiding in a pretrial setting, resolving these motions to dismiss, to suppress, to make decisions about what evidence will come in. Those are called motions in limine, limiting the kinds of things that can be presented during the course of a trial. Judges can make decisions about which cases, which arguments in support and in opposition to a particular position, which of those motions should be at the front of the judicial review, should really be given some clear consideration by the judge, and which ones are truly in the nature of insignificant things. Things that can be disposed of summarily because either they're so completely meritless on their face, or there are other things about the facts of the case, the procedure, that makes it inappropriate, unnecessary to conduct hearings. And judges, including those before whom I appeared routinely in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Michigan when I was there, even sometimes in the District of Columbia Circuit, all around the country, routinely make those decisions about what can and should not be the subject of full-blown hearings. Eileen Cannon, in addition to many other concerns about her management in this pretrial setting, has been conducting hearings, about virtually every single motion that has come before her. And that includes what's going on right now. And so what's happening in Fort Pierce, in front of Judge Cannon right now, is her meticulous review of every single one of these motions, including a 3-day hearing now underway on one of those motions that I would offer falls in the category of things that maybe you take a little bit of time to address, but do not deserve this kind of focus. One of the many motions presented by the defense on behalf of Donald Trump is whether or not Jack Smith was properly named by the Attorney General as the special counsel. And we can go into a great deal of detail. The focus of this is on the established law already. And the reality is that this issue about whether or not an attorney general has the capacity to appoint a special counsel, it's already been resolved. It's been resolved many times over the period of the past decades. It's been resolved in connection of Bob Mueller's review, his position as a special counsel looking at the Russia investigation. It was resolved in other iterations, other names for these kinds of people who look at things independent or at least somewhat independently of the Department of Justice. All of this has been the subject of review by not only lower courts, but also by the United States Supreme Court, including recently. Brett Kavanaugh himself have said that these special counsel appointments are constitutional. And yet, as we will talk, Eileen Cannon revisiting this issue, having a hearing on this issue as the proceedings in front of her go ahead. We'll talk more about that as Amicus, a law review, continues here on the stations of Civic Media.
News from the Center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. For tens of millions of people, no relief from the record heat. ABC's Morgan Norwood has more.
More than 110 million Americans facing a weekend of dangerous and excessive heat. From Indiana to Pittsburgh, feels like temperatures could reach up to 105 degrees. The blistering heat across the eastern seaboard creating potentially life-threatening conditions for those outdoors for prolonged periods.
Authorities emphasizing hydration and water safety. Three people from Alabama drowned Friday while swimming off Panama City Beach on the Florida Panhandle, while police in New York City searching for two teenagers missing after they were seen being overtaken by a large wave swimming Friday evening. Former President Trump has campaign events today in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. President Biden spending the weekend at Camp David, and authorities in Arkansas still investigating the motive of the mass shooting in Fordyce that left three people dead. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers lose in San Diego. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers lost to the Padres 9-5 at Petco Park. The Padres with 9 runs off of 15 hits. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
They hit the ball tremendous tonight. The Padres were tremendous. They've been, since that win in Philadelphia, they've been playing great, swinging the bat great.
Brewers reliever Hobie Milner charged with the loss. Hockey, the Stanley Cup Finals. The Oilers beat the Panthers again, this time 5-1. So now the series moves back to Florida for a final game set. Monday night, face-off 7 o'clock. NFL, the Packers training camp now a month away. I asked Romeo Dobbs if this is a good time to finish memorizing the playbook.
Yeah, growth is everything, you know. Coach always says it. It's either you're getting better or getting worse, and I believe that every guy in our room has gotten better throughout the course of this offseason. And again, to make it short, I'm looking forward to it.
That's Packers wide receiver Romeo Dobbs with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Showers and thunderstorms likely today, heavy rainfall and some flooding possible, a high near 83. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms with a low of 62. We clear things out for Sunday, mostly sunny, a high near 80. Warmer on Monday with a high around 86.
It's 73 at our studios.
It's official. Governor Tony Evers proclaims this June as Pride Month in Wisconsin. But did you know the state has a long history of activism alongside LGBTQ plus communities and allies? The Civic Media Radio Network supports the impact and celebrations and is sharing thoughtful stories all month long.
Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam fell in love in the 1930s. But they also fell in love with Mineral Point, Wisconsin, where they worked together to rescue and restore buildings set to be demolished. The gay couple gave Cornish language names to those properties. The best known may be Pendarvis, a piece of history from the mid-1800s when Mineral Point was a lead mining town. Their success during the Great Depression is considered the start of what's turned the area into an art and tourism hub. It's a story of love and preservation, and you can still experience it today thanks to Bob and Edgar. I'm Terry Barr.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on News from the Center. 107.7 FM and 1450 AM WRCE and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
What is the worst movie franchise? Do you have one, Conrad?
What are your thoughts on Transformers?
I saw one Transformer movie. I think it was the first one. I didn't even know what the hell was going on.
I can't get into them anymore because, you know, it's the same every movie now.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice if you knew which Transformer. I know there's like testosterone and overload and whatever the, you know.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Maggie Dawn.
It is day 16 and week 4 of Joe Biden's Top 100. Our theme this week, healthcare. You're not going to want to miss a single episode.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking now about more things happening in the courts of America. Judge Eileen Cannon, U.S. District Judge in South Florida, entertaining motions in the pretrial stage. No trial date set. Trial not at all likely to go in this calendar year, maybe not even next calendar year at this particular pace. Why? Because in part, Judge Cannon entertaining every single motion that's coming up in front of the defense, which she should do, but doing it in a way that slows things down. In particular, she began on Friday a three-day hearing on, among other things, the allegation that by virtue of appointing Jack Smith as the special counsel in this Mar-a-Lago documents case, allegation by the defense presenting this to her, that the Justice Department has created a shadow government, their words, not mine, through the appointment process of the special counsel to prosecute these cases. And of course, prosecutors pushing back on that, not only saying that there is authority to do this, but that this is long settled, and indeed they're correct. And nonetheless, the attorneys presenting these arguments in front of Judge Cannon obliged to present not only this precedent, but to tell her that these matters have long been resolved. Indeed, there's an awful lot of authority out there to suggest that these kinds of appointments have been settled by not only the Supreme Court, by the legislature, our federal Congress as well. This kind of thing, that is the appointment of a special counsel, has been done historically, again, with support both legislatively and judicially. The regulation under this particular rubric, if you will, is that the Attorney General does indeed have the authority to appoint a special counsel in cases where the Justice Department investigation would present a conflict of interest. That's one aspect of this, or some other extraordinary circumstances. And cases called Morrison versus Olson, others out there, have specifically supported doing this. This is settled law. Notable special counsels in U.S. history include Ken Starr, the Clinton Whitewater investigation, Lawrence Walsh, Iran-Contra, and many others out there. And the point of all of that history, the arguments being made right now by Jack Smith's attorneys to Eileen Cannon, is that there is not only nothing to see here, but this is settled law. Nonetheless, engaging in not only extended conversation, but asking counsel for the special counsel to tell her more about whether or not the Attorney General is involved, and if so, in the ways in which he is involved in this. Now, the attorneys for Jack Smith have declined appropriately to engage in that discussion. No obligation whatsoever for any attorneys to tell a judge or a justice about the backdoor discussions, if you will, inside discussions among the attorneys themselves about legal issues, about strategies, things behind closed doors, appropriately kept in that setting. But she continues to have this hearing. And again, it is continuing on Monday. And at that time, she is not only going to be considering more of this, but it's also indicated that she's going to be taking up again this request from Jack Smith, which he has raised before, about whether or not that should be an order preventing Donald Trump from talking about the terms and conditions by which that search warrant was conducted at his Mar-a-Lago residence in August of 22. Again, argued previously, presented previously, and she is entertaining that issue again, rather than simply disposing of it one way or another. She has also indicated along the way that she's going to be taking up many other hearings, scheduling other hearings and taking up other motions as a part of this overall process. Again, absolutely obliged to do this, absolutely required as in her role as a judge who's presiding over this case to address and resolve motions. But a good and experienced judge knows which among these are significant. A motion to suppress, for example, given the circumstances of the search, might, under appropriate circumstances, be properly brought to her, properly disposed of by her. Maybe a motion to dismiss based upon the context, the status of the charges against Donald Trump and the others, all of that. But a good judge knows what to call forth and what kinds of things can be dismissed summarily. In the end, my view of all of this, as I indicated to Thomas earlier in our program this weekend, three things that she is doing. One is all of this, of course, a distraction from the fundamental focus, which is the allegations against Donald Trump. very serious allegations, allegations that many people regard as perhaps the most compelling of all of the four criminal cases pending against him. One of those now resolved in New York with a finding of violations of New York state law. This one, an awful lot of people look at it and say, this is the most straightforward. All of this, a distraction from that principal focus, which would be upon those issues if indeed they talked about things like the search, the context, and the content of the indictment against Donald Trump. All of this, a distraction encouraged effectively by Judge Eileen Cannon. It also, of course, accomplishes a delay. All of these hearings make clear that this particular trial will not be conducted at any time in the near future, certainly not during this calendar year, arguably sometime in 2025, maybe even beyond. And the third D, beyond distractions and delay, a disparaging, if you will, of the very prosecutors who appear before her, the suggestion that they themselves are the products of and are engaging in inappropriate, ill-motivated actions in doing this. No support to suggest that at all. And yet, all of that a part of what she is doing on a routine basis. Distractions, delay, and disparagement, all of this resulting, in effect, in a delay in the ultimate disposition of this case. An awful lot of things can be identified and brought up under what's called the Speedy Trial Act to ensure that all these issues have complete exposition, that defense counsel have the opportunity to argue them. No one is indicating that those things should not happen. But the discretion that judges and justices should apply in determining what's important and what isn't important, all of this suggesting that Judge Cannon herself is engaging in delays and distractions and disparagements that are not a part of our expectations for judges, much as Thomas indicated in our first hour. We also know in recent times, reported reliably by a number of different sources, including the New York Times, that Judge Cannon early on was approached not only by the chief judge of the district, by another judge in that district, recommending strongly that she recuse herself from this case based upon her prior handling of that civil case attacking this investigation even before it led to the grand jury indictment that is now before her. She was apparently randomly assigned to the criminal case, but at least two judges coming to her in advance of all of this happening, telling her that in the wake of her prior involvement, she should recuse herself. She has plainly decided not to do that, again, raising the question that Thomas raises, that others have raised about whether or not there is not simply a conflict of interest here based upon her prior involvement, but also certainly an appearance of impropriety. And that, of course, the subject of continuing focus, Thomas's question ultimately, what do you do? What do you do in this circumstance? My suspicion is that Jack Smith, as a part of his role of special counsel here, is keeping a list, if you will, of the things that are concerning, that raise not only appearances of impropriety, but also arguably conflicts that may in fact ultimately result in a petition, maybe to the chief judge, maybe to the 11th Circuit, that it was, we know, previously told her that she was way out of line in dealing with the civil case. All of that may come forth at some point down the road if Jack Smith decides to pursue this more directly and seeks her recusal, not at her own action, but based upon something that a higher judge, a district court judge, the chief judge, or a judge or a panel of judges from the 11th Circuit might arguably do. All of that could be in the offing as we continue to monitor and view what is going on in South Florida and the administration of this case by Judge Eileen Cannon. No trial date at all as we go into more hearings coming up this coming week. We've got a couple more callers. Always appreciate inquiries and questions about the subject matter of our discussion. Appreciate very much Bill calling in from Oconomowoc this weekend. Bill, your question or your inquiry.
Good morning. Great show. How bad has the architecture of our justice system, our Supreme Court, our jurisprudence, everything, how bad has it been twisted, and how long will it take till we cover from this destruction of our normal practice of law? What do you think?
Bill, great question, and we could write volumes on that, right, and talk at great length. Like to think that that's what a part of our broadcast is all about. Plainly, it is set by the conduct of people. And I would offer, as we've discussed before on this broadcast, it comes from the Supreme Court, right? If Chief Justice John Roberts establishes at some point for his court a code of ethics. That's where it starts. You look to the people at the very top, and you see that they themselves are subject to recusal requirements and mandates for their behavior. This issue about accepting gifts and other things from personal friends appearing in front of them effectively through their own counsel, all of those kinds of things. It starts from the top. And then it also requires all of the judges themselves, whether they're state court judges, federal court judges, also having before them the words of the oath that every single judge and justice takes. That is to support a constitution, the constitution of their state, the constitution of the United States of America. What does all of that require them to do? It's to administer justice fairly and decently. Yes, to give everybody an option to present arguments, to ensure that due process is promoted, that equal protection is a part of their of the litigation, whether it's civil or criminal, that that's their oath of office, and that they are not in any way misdirected by, Bill, what I suspect your question prompts, which is this notion that somehow I've got another agenda out there, that I've got a political agenda, that I've got something else out there that may, in fact, prompt me to put that oath of office to one side, that prompts me to set it aside and say, I've got some other agendas here. We have seen that regrettably recently with Sam Alito, and I've made the petition here on our weekend program about the reasons why, based upon his cynicism with respect to the basic trappings of our government, that he should no longer be a justice. Plenty of concerns about Sam Alito, concerns about Eileen Cannon going forward in the wake of what was identified by another judge, a set of judges in the 11th Circuit, telling her that her conduct is way outside the realm of something appropriate and decent inside the trappings of normal jurisprudence, all of that suggesting that these judges need to reconsider their involvement in particular cases, need to consider whether they're frankly in the right positions here. Your role is to be fair and is be decent. That's what we require of you. It requires examples. And there are. There are great justices. There are good justices out there in our nation's history. There are tremendous judges in our federal and state courts here in the state of Wisconsin, beyond, who do that every single day. And it's always when the judges and justices who do not follow that, that come to our attention, that we begin to think that our justice system, with some cause, is not on that road toward a complete, imperfect delivery of unbiased and fair justice for all people. Your question, which is not just rhetorical, it's also practical, Bill, is one that should animate also our political discussion of this time. What kinds of justices, candidates for the presidency, will you appoint? What is their commitment? What are the kinds of people who you're going to appoint to the federal bench? And we should ask that also of the people who are running for office, running for judicial positions in the state of Wisconsin and other states. What is your sense of justice, and how will you approach your system? Can we get the absolute assurance from you, as you are running for these positions in an elective judiciary, that you will not be subject to bias and other prejudice that will impact the results that you provide? Great question, Bill. We'll continue to wrestle with it as we go forward. Dick from Madison calling in. Also appreciate your inquiry on Amicus Law Review.
This latest thing that the judge is asking for.
Yes.
He's asking for more information, correct?
Absolutely. She's asking for more information about the nature of the relationship between Jack Smith and the attorney general, which, again, the attorneys there have said, you know, a judge, with all due respect, can't be disclosing those things. Those are protected. And she knows that. And so underscores once again the impropriety of the questioning. Yes.
So I guess what I'm saying in bringing that up is it proves to me that she's totally incompetent, because she should have known this going in. And some of the best advice she got, I just read about, is that I think there's three judges in that jurisdiction.
At least two, yes. Yep.
And one retired, two that aren't, that told her she should totally recuse herself from the situation, correct?
Right. So you've got other judges looking at this and saying, yes, she should recuse herself, exactly.
Totally out of bounds. So to my way of thinking, those two things alone prove how totally incompetent she is. And why are you even asking for information? Because you're not going to take it.
Right. Dick, appreciate the comment. Appreciate the observation. As we continue to talk about all this, when we continue with Amicus, a law review, we'll talk about more constitutional issues here on our broadcast on Civic Media.
This is News from the Setter, WRCE.
Progressive presents 10 things on a contractor's to-do list that are harder than getting a commercial auto insurance quote. Bidding a new client, giving an accurate estimate, finding affordable materials, getting a client to pay you for work you already did, getting a client to pay you, period, securing permits and workers and tools, getting those workers and tools to work together, and finding the perfect pair of overalls. Pockets, baby. But the easiest thing on a small business owner's to-do list? Seeing if you can save on commercial auto insurance. Get a quote in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Coverage subject to policy terms and conditions.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot. Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was. When they moved the camera, whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Solar Review in our final minutes, discussing yet another issue, a constitutional issue raised by the actions of Louisiana legislatures just this past week. A law signed by the governor there in Louisiana, his name is Jeff Landry, signs this law on Wednesday, requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in every public school classroom in Louisiana, making it the only state with such a mandate, and basically reigniting, once again, a matter that's been settled for well over 40 years in America. The particular legislation here in Louisiana requires that the commandments be displayed in each classroom of every public elementary, middle, and high school, as well as public college classrooms. The posters, according to the legislation, is very specific, must be no smaller than 11 by 14 inches, and the commandments must be the, quote, central focus of the poster and in a large, easily readable font. It also will include, according to the legislation, a three-paragraph statement asserting that the Ten Commandments were, quote, a prominent part of American public education for almost three centuries. That reflects plainly the contention by supporters here of this legislation, as they've said that the Ten Commandments are not purely a religious text, but also an historical document, and they argue that the instructions handed down by God to Moses in the book of Exodus are a major influence on United States law. All of that happening about 40 years, more than 40 years after the United States Supreme Court struck down exactly that same kind of thing, coming out of Kentucky, a case called Stone versus Graham. Stone versus Graham in 1980, rejecting that very notion, indicating clearly that there's no secular legislative purpose in doing this, and that this is plainly religious in nature. What they're doing is plainly invoking, yes, that's right, the First Amendment, that mandates that the Congress, as the language of the amendment says, but also interpreted generally to mean government. Government can make no law establishing a religion, cannot do anything in any way to affect the exercise of that religion. But clearly at that time and to this day, the United States Supreme Court, as have other courts, have been striking down things exactly like this that have no legislative secular purpose and that are plainly religious in nature, that do in fact establish inside public institutions such as this, the public schools in Louisiana, stricken down on a routine basis, not only back in 1980 in Stone versus Graham, on the basis that it is effectively establishing a religion inside our public institutions, contrary to what the Supreme Court has said on a routine basis. Now, again, as we have talked on a regular basis here on this broadcast, this is a part of a larger effort, if you will, to roll back time. We have talked a lot, even this weekend, about interests of Supreme Court justices in looking to the past and finding once again a reason to resurrect old issues long resolved. We know that that is happening again. Recall well the case coming out of the Supreme Court, Kennedy versus Bremerton, when the Supreme Court basically found that the longstanding prohibition on prayer in schools, long established, once again, the same kind of thing, saying that prayer in schools serve no secular legislative purpose. They're plainly religious in nature. They're promoting a particular religion. Those kinds of things contrary to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Kennedy versus Bremerton case written by Justice Gorsuch, an opinion written by him, finding that this football coach can, in fact, appropriately, constitutionally, have prayer with members of his team on the 50-yard line of a football field after a Friday evening football game. Wildly, wildly contrary to an awful lot of prior precedent, prompting, of course, Sonia Sotomayor to question out loud, showing a picture of this when Justice Gorsuch had said, well, this is a private, non-public kind of event just led by this particular coach. Justice Sotomayor taking him to task for that particular factual description of this. But nonetheless, that kind of law, that kind of a prohibition set forth by our First Amendment, plainly not observed in that case called Kennedy versus Bremerton. And the point of that is that that Bremerton case, giving encouragement, if you will, to these folks in Louisiana and others around the nation who might seek to turn back time once again, to say that, you know what happened in 1980, this Stone versus Graham case that expressly said that the Ten Commandments, this reference to God and Moses in the Bible, in the Torah, cannot be a part of our public education because we do not establish a particular religion. We do not promote Judaism or Christianity above other religions. We are a pluralistic nation with all sorts of religions, and none of them can be repressed. All of them can be exercised by particular congregants, but we also don't establish a religion. And this particular action by the Louisiana legislature flies in the face of all of that. The measure, according to the legislature, allows for our children to look up and see what God says is right and what he says is wrong. One of the advocates for it says it doesn't preach a certain religion, but it definitely shows a moral code we should all live by. Now, plainly critics say that this legislation, as I advocate here on our broadcast, a clear constitutional violation. And indeed, you've got groups that are going to be challenging this in the courts there in Louisiana. Arguably one of these cases that will once again come up to the Supreme Court decades after this has been long established. Joint statement by the American Civil Liberties Union, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the Southern Poverty Law Center, all of them coming together and arguing definitively, clearly for what is right here, and that is that the law plainly, unmistakably violates the students and the families' fundamental right to religious freedom. All of that coming forward, one of the spokesmen for these groups saying that public schools are not Sunday schools, and students of all faiths or no faith should feel welcome in them. That is a reference, basically, to this case way back in 1980 to Stone versus Graham, in which the Supreme Court said exactly that. The law, plainly there in Louisiana, a product of this legislative season in which lawmakers have done a number of different things. In a special session this year, lawmakers rolled back a previous overhaul of some of the previous reforms in the criminal justice system. They passed bills to lengthen the sentences for some offenses. They strictly limited access to parole. They promoted the prosecution of 17-year-olds charged with any crime as adults. And they also allowed methods of execution beyond lethal injection. All of that coming out of this particular legislature. They also advanced the first in the nation measures designating abortion pills as dangerous controlled substances and allowing judges to order surgical castration of child sex offenders. All of that coming out of this Louisiana legislature just in recent times. The latest articulation, this requirement that public schools and public colleges post the Ten Commandments, and that it come along with this explanation that is plainly a part of a religious tradition. All of that, the subject plainly of future discussion here on Amicus Law Review. As always, appreciate your time with me this weekend. Invite you back again next weekend as we continue our further examination of our United States Supreme Court and the decisions certain to come out in the coming week. Have a good weekend and a good week, everybody. Take care.
News from the Center, WRCE. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, more and more UW-Madison students are interested in learning about public policy and sinkholes. Why? We'll find out. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on News from the Center. 107.7 FM and 1450 AM WRCE and on the Civic Media app.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.